that could streamline or make easier and more accountable the work that you do with agencies. And this all traces back to a presentation that Full Ways and Means had about 3 weeks ago from five private sector folks who came in and talked a little bit about certain state processes. And one of the things that was pointed out as being particularly deficient was in our whole information technology arena, how computers are talking to each other, how our systems are networked. And so I was trying to get a sense from you all that if there was a particular agency not pointing at management deficiencies, but rather hunting for things that were within the legislature's purview to rectify, if there was some pattern that was instructive to us to make the cash management job that you do and the advice that you give to agencies easier. And that was the whole point of the question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, and I really can't point something specific like that. The agencies are so diverse, and their differences and their needs are so different, and we work with them on different levels and on different issues that
varies by statute.
But I can't point to an overriding fix like that that would make my life a lot easier. Wish I could.
Okay.
Darren, I'm wondering if we could have just one more list back from you, and if you'd just submit it. I guess that the list of those agencies whose funds inure to the general fund versus back to the agency is something that varies by statute. And so what I'm concerned about is if there are a lot of, if that should be more uniform, is there any logic behind it? And then what I would like to do is I'd like to have you meet and deliver that information, if you would, please, to Representative Johnson, and meet with her about any specific concerns that you might be able to assuage any of the concerns that she would have relative to anyone who doesn't manage their cash the way that they ought to. And that way you're able to relay that on to Representative Johnson, and then she can express any concerns that she may have to our co-chairs at that point. But I would like to know, excuse me, what specific agencies have their account balances and the earnings at the daily amounts of the pool go to the general fund versus back to the agency themselves. Is that a possibility?
Mr. Chair, I believe so. One thing to note is it's not on an agency basis. It's on an account-by-account basis. So
you say account-by-account.
Account. Oh. So it's determined at the account level, not at the agency level. So a new account is established for the Fish and Wildlife, for instance, and it's a Fish and Wildlife account for a particular hatchery program, and that account will then may or may not be allowed to retain its own interest.
And the may or may not is statutory?
It's statutory. So there's several hundred accounts, and of those accounts, then the statute defines whether or not it retains its own interest. Now,
could you do a print off of that, Darren? Is that a possibility?
I can try.
Okay.
I can go back and probably identify all the accounts that are currently accruing to the general fund. It might take me a couple of days. But
that'd be fine. And then if you'll just make arrangements to meet with Representative Johnson so that we can address any of, because as a member of Full Ways and Means, she'll see all of the budgets at some particular point in time. I'd like for her to have firsthand knowledge of anyone that has problems managing their cash balance.
Mr. Chair, I will say that there is definitely a trend that has been increasing over the last several sessions, where more and more accounts are established retaining their own interest with their interest diverted away from
okay.
the general fund. It's rare now that the general fund retains the interest from accounts.
Okay. So maybe just give us that list of those that do inure to the general fund, and that if that's possible, where those are at. But also, I would hope that, and I'm sure the Treasurer's Office is proactive in that regard, I'd hope that you would, if you see any red flags begin to be forming on the horizon, that you'd be able to tell us in advance. So if you'll just share that with Representative Johnson, I would appreciate it, and we'll be able to share it back with the Coast. Thank you. Thank you.
Maybe a couple of other points relative to cash management. We want to make it also clear that when we do have the authority, as we were describing yesterday, to conduct cash management audits, and we do report that back to the legislature as well as the DAS. So you are in the loop relative to receiving those, and I believe we're going to have two come up, two different agencies within the next couple of months. So be sure to get those. And as far as technology, Representative Johnson, one thing we are looking at right now is looking at more online banking, which could enhance cash management both from our side and the agency side, as well as extending that out to some of our local government partners as well. So we're sort of beta testing that and working through that right now.
Okay. Thank you very much, Treasurer Edwards. Item number five.
Five was clarifying the question on vacant positions, and I think yesterday we were talking using vacant positions in a couple of different definitional ways. So this answer qualifies vacant positions in terms of how you're looking at them budgetarily and how they're shown in our budget. We currently have four vacant positions. Two of those are going to be abolished. So that means we have two open positions, and those are the ones I talked about yesterday that we're actually in the process of seeing how they fit better in the agency. So we do want to carry those two positions over into the next biennium.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And then the final question, Mr. Chair, was with regard to the differences between the 01-03 estimated budget and the from a revenue perspective, and the 03-05 governor's recommended budget that was in our budget, our document itself. And I think some of the difficulty that we saw the committee with yesterday was the budget that was presented as the governor's recommended budget and then our revised budget, and trying to rationalize information we were providing relative to specifics of the budget as presented to the governor and then our revised request. So on the attachment to the responses to the questions, we've gone through and adjusted what we would seem to be the revenue projection with the revised 03-05 budget. And let me just stress that this is something that we went through yesterday in our offices, so it hasn't been fully vetted and stress tested. We haven't had the chance to work with our Dallas to make sure that it all plays out. But I think that this is going to be pretty close.
Working passage, recognized.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This is helpful, but it still doesn't get me where I'm looking to go. I'm interested in the historical trend of what the charges are, because that's obviously going to affect revenue. So I'm interested in historical trend, but I mean, you gave us your fee schedule to local governments on banking services, and then your explanation says you've lowered those particular fees at some point in time during the 01-03. I'm interested to know, you know, historically what those fees have done, so we can tell, and maybe some more detail, especially since we've had some dramatic losses and other things in the last 2 years. Why we continue to, the state investment piece continues to rise as much as it rises. I still don't understand that. Maybe you can explain those more. We don't have to do it today because I know we have another budget, but I'm just concerned with what the rates are doing and why we continue to pay more. Are we paying a higher basis point amount to manage the current portfolio or what?
And we'd be happy to work with you to get that detail.
And with the revised revenue at $24,759,735 for the 0305, and matching that to the revised 0305 budget at $24,648,260, that gives us freeboard of about $111,000. Is that according to what your recollection is, Linda?
That does seem reasonable, and
$111,475 is what I'm coming up with, mm-hmm. the difference between this $24,759 and the $24,648 figure on your revised calculation of your budget.
And again, our budget is expenditures. This is revenue. So
right,
this would have some cash reserves.
So that would give you about $111,000 cash reserves. Is that what you were anticipating from current operations? Okay. Yep. Other questions relative to the explanation on number six? Thank you very much. Other questions? Representative Patrick.
I just have a question. While I got an answer from LFO, which I appreciate on the cash balance targets, I was trying to see if, you know, the treasurer looks at the cash flow on a continual basis. The treasurer's office looks at a cash flow on a continual basis, and I'm wondering, based upon cash flow needs, if there's been anything that's identified that they have too large a reserve on their cash flow balances. We never get to see. I mean, you guys tell us too, but we never get to see any of the cash flow issues as a committee. And I know that that's been raised as concerns by several members. So,
is that question addressed to me or to the treasurer?
I'm just wondering, Dallas, how do we address the cash flow? How do we address the cash flow issues as committees as we look at these things? And where have we seen cash flows dip? I mean, that's great if they have three months as kind of the generalized target, but how often have we seen historically some of those cash flows dip below that 90 days? Or
we still do the chart, Dallas. At one time, we used to do a chart. Budget management used to assist us with a chart over a period of 48 months and show us historically what the ending cash balance at the end of each month was, and then what the projected for the next biennium was. Do we still have any of that capacity in our cadre?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we could. The projection pretty much is in here. We could, at specific points in time, we can look at and pull out of the accounting system the cash that is there. To expand on my memo here, we, from an oversight perspective, we look at it, budget management looks at it, where the cash balances are at the time the budgets are presented, to see if there is going to be an excess or what is felt to be more than enough, in which case they would try to drive down the revenues or allow for some expenditure increase that was requested possibly in an option package. We, too, look at that also with an eye more towards reductions. To fund it not out of revenues or general fund resources or other funds, but to fund it out of cash balances. And then the mechanism is really tracking expenditures to budget. If there's a fall off in revenues, they let us know. Generally, we are informed when they have to go to borrow from Treasury. Sometimes agencies have to cut back on staffing or whatever because of a drop-off in cash flow. Embarrassments of riches, of course, aren't brought to our attention as often, but we try to monitor that through, we limit the expenditures, and then as we get close to through the budget process at the end of the biennium, if we see there's an excess of cash there, we would not permit, if you will, increased expenditures just to absorb that cash balance, but then use that cash balance and to offset the upcoming budget request. I know that's not addressing on point your question, but it really is an agency by agency operational thing, and we rely on the agencies to monitor it. We do know that when they have problems, they surface a lot more quickly than when they have the extra cash. We tend to find that out a little bit later on, and then we address that. I can give you some examples with this last number of reductions in budgets through the special sessions. We were going back to try to utilize existing balances and the like.
But we've seen a lot of these balance transfers. We've seen a lot of the cash flow balances on, like, these little tiny fee-for-service agencies, but we never see them. We never see them on the big agencies, I guess. I mean, how often does the state treasurer's cash dipped below? I mean, It's like 2.6 million if you've got to do 90 days. How often have they dipped below the 2.6 million during the biennium in terms of their cash flow? Do they need $2 million in cash flow?
Well,
for their own budget. I mean, you know, this is your own budget, obviously.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, within the...
Is that in our materials there?
Yes, under revenues C4. And these are static points in time. So you can see what our cash balance was when they captured the estimates of 1.4, and then what we're projecting to have in our request, and then also running it through the governor's budget and ending budget of 2.1 and 2.0 million.
Linda, are these the revised amounts?
No.
Okay.
No. Specific to your question, the 90 day objective, and actually ours is 2 months. We don't use 90 days. We're targeting 2 months. That is a reserve, and a reserve is the purpose of it is the cushion. So you wouldn't. It gives you a chance to go under it. To go under it is not an issue. The reserve is there so you have enough money to pay your bills. Where there's a problem with agencies is where they go through their reserves and then have no money to pay their bills.
So I understand how cash management works.
Right.
I think my issue is how often do we have agencies dipping into their reserves on a continual basis, and are the targets proper? I guess there's not a policy discussion typically, at least in the 3 years that I've been on Ways and Means, as to what's the proper cash balance for the agencies, other than these little commissions and
3 to 6 months.
If we may, we could call up Darren Bond, because last session we amended a bill, we amended a statute to require some reporting based on agencies' shortfalls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, I believe that I think one indication would be the activity in interfund borrowings. If they run out of reserves, they're going to borrow from us to be able to do business. There's very little. We do very few interfund borrowings on a regular basis, if we're not counting the general fund for loaning to on a daily basis. So in terms of most agency activity, we don't see a recurring problem with their ability to manage to adequate levels of cash. You see certain issues come up on a cyclical basis occasionally. Fire, the Department of Forestry with fire issues, they've had two very bad fire seasons. They blew through a bunch of cash, and we help support them through that. Occasionally, we've seen in the past, Fish and Wildlife would have large receivables from the federal government in Bonneville that would be delayed in payment, and we would help support them through that. But other than that, it's a very sporadic, very very rare kind of occurrence, usually associated with some kind of a significant event, some kind of a significant payable that's delayed, and or receivable that's delayed. Excuse me. So we don't, at our level, we don't see that, and that's the kind of thing, that's where we would see it, because we don't have any information as to what their budget is, what their appropriate reserves would be. I think another thing to note relative to management of reserves is that DAS does go through an effort on an annual basis to identify agency reserves, working capital reserves. It's a requirement of the federal government because we're audited against that, and if we keep too large an amount of reserves, and the federal government charges us for that. So that's another control on excess. Not the federal government's happy if we minimize our working capital balances, but they don't want us to keep excess balances because, of course, they're concerned that there's federal dollars in those that they would rather be working and earning the interest on than having us do that. So,
Mr. Chair, and I understand that, but I guess that's part of what we're trying to get. I mean, that's part of what Representative Johnson and I and everyone else are trying to get to, is you handle the cash. You're the cash managers. You handle the reserves. You know about the Treasurer's Office knows about the interfund borrowing. You know, does each agency need to stand alone as a in terms of capital reserve, in terms of cash reserves? Can we pool the cash reserves and have a lower amount so that we have more money for this next budget cycle? Are there other opportunities that are there in terms of what the state's cash flow needs are as a state that we can optimize as a result of what can be discovered? I mean, it's all in your shop, and while DAS has some responsibility in the LFO, I guess that's what we're asking is, you know, there's a policy decision as to what's the right amount of cash reserves we need to keep on hand.
You've given us the cash reserves from the Treasury, and you must be able to total up all of the agencies and all the sub-accounts for every day, I would think.
Mr. Chair, we have about $3.5 billion of cash reserves.
And that belongs to each of many, many accounts.
Right.
One way to get to what I think Representative Patridge is alluding to would be to say, has that changed from month to month, seriously, over a longer period of time, of those cash reserves? If you've got $3.5 billion of cash reserves today, at the end of the day, or at the end of the night last night, for the month of March, how does that compare to the end of the month of March a year ago? And how does it compare, you know, if you went backwards, is that declining? Is that increasing? Is there some resource there? Is there some agency that is accumulating more than it needs during any period of time? I think that's kind of where we're trying to get at, to find out if there's any agency that might be in a cash management situation. Yes, we know that you're pooling it, that you're earning the daily amount on it, which may or may not come to the general fund, might go back into the specific account to which it's earning the interest. The question then becomes, what's the history, and is there any opportunity for us to take a look at that history? Darren, do you have that history?
Mr. Chair, sure. The history and the trend is that it's increasing. As the size of the budget increases, the size of our balance increases. As the size of local government budgets increase, of course, also it increases. We're running between $7 and $8 billion of balance in the Oregon Short Term Fund. Those are historic. That's historic highs.
And that's pooled.
Over the course of the last year or so, we've reached $8 billion for the first time in the total pool of local government and state monies.
And I don't know that we're going to try and I would certainly hope that we would never be worried about, other than just making sure that you're managing it properly and returning the money to the local governments, that we would ever be anxious about that, because I would like to make sure that local money is protected and vouchsafed. I think our concern here is with regard to those agencies over which we have budgetary responsibility in general government, then the subcommittees, the Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, again, what we can show you is that the balances are increasing, and that
increasing proportionately with the size of government increase.
That would be my guess, although I haven't run the numbers to be able to determine.
Maybe we ought to just have you run those numbers if you could, Darren. Again, if you can report that back to either Representative Patridge or Representative Johnson, that would be appropriate. Just give us some benchmark what that looks like. As I'm looking at this $1.457 million that you're going to end up with on June 30, estimated for the 0103 ending budget, and then I were to add the $111,000 that we have from the current estimates of resource versus the expenditure, that really isn't going to give you 2 months based upon the numbers that Representative Patridge is coming up with on a monthly basis. So if your estimates are that you're going to be running on 2 months, you're going to be running short of the 2 months during the entire biennium. Well, I don't know, during the entire biennium. From end to end, you'd be running short, would appear. Representative Patridge is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, and that's my point. I mean, part of my point is we complain about we don't have a rainy day fund, we don't have all these other funds, but we don't even have. But I'm trying to get our arms around what our cash management is. I'm trying to get a good feeling for, not that you're not managing the cash management, but what's the appropriate right sizing for cash management of the state as we look at the state as a group. And I can't say that I understand all the federal nuances. I knew that there was some penalties for keeping too many reserves and those kinds of things, but. In this time of budget crisis, what's the appropriate level of reserves that state agencies should be keeping as an overall? And if you said it's $3.5 billion right now that we're keeping as cash reserves, I mean, I don't know what the volatility tolerances are. I don't know what this. I don't know what the cycles are. And only you can help us understand. I mean, only the Treasurer's Office to a great degree, and maybe with the help of BAM and LFO can help us do those things. But is it appropriate right now in this time of economic crisis to have, you know, on average 90 days cash on hand in all the state agencies when we've got huge budget problems and big issues to deal with? I don't know, because I don't know what the tolerances are for the current budget crisis. But now's the time when you spend reserves, when you have continued economic problems, and you can see that, I think, in the state treasurer's budget. But it looks like you put down $2 million worth of reserves, which is a substantial portion of your reserves. Are other state agencies doing that? Have we seen a huge decline, or do we have money spirited away in places that we don't know about? So, I mean, that's the larger policy issue, I think, that the legislature has to address, and I think the public wants us to have every stone unturned. I don't think running out with any kind of revenue measure or anything else without looking at what's prudent, and if there's, you know, 90 days cash balances in all these agencies and we never dip below and we don't have problems at 60 days, can we spend that 30 days worth of cash balances?
Dallas, do you want to respond to that?
I think Treasury would like to. Go ahead. Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the Treasurer, correct me if I'm wrong, has responsibility for a pool of cash that isn't accessible in large measure by the legislature in many cases, because, you know, that pool of cash, a part of it may be safes, reserves, PERS, cash, and the like. So if the question is operating cash for agencies, that's different from, you know, like an ODOT, which has its responsibilities, versus a Department of Human Services, versus a Treasury, Office of the Treasurer. I think those cash balances are different from those which can't be accessed, which would be like the safe and PERS.
I understand that, but we still have $10.1 billion projected during this next biennium of state general funds. It's available to be spent. They know what the Treasurer's Office knows what the restrictions are on their accounts and the money that they hold to a great degree. And what's the appropriate, I mean, I know the $3.5 billion probably includes ODOT and some of these other agencies that are running around out there, but what's the appropriate level of general fund reserves that we're able to keep? And, you know, we can't go out and spend all the federal funds either, or, I mean, there's restrictions on all that, but I don't know. I don't know if the question's been asked. I don't know. It appears that the question's not been asked, but I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, I should clarify that when we're talking about that currently, of that $3.5 billion, there's no general fund. The general fund is in a deficit position. General fund's projected to be in a deficit cash position for the entirety of next biennium. Even with the balanced budget, we'll balance at the beginning of, you know, day one of the biennium, we'll be balanced it at the final day of the biennium, and the general fund will be in a deficit cash position for the entirety of the biennium now, based on current cash flow projections. So there are no general fund cash reserves.
What's the limit on our TANs?
That's all I need to know.
Yeah. Okay.
What was the limit on our TANs?
We don't have a limit.
We didn't put a limit on the TANs, just whatever was necessary.
Basically, the limit will be imposed by the market on what's perceived that we can be afforded, what our backup sources of repayment are,
okay,
et cetera.
Because at one point, I think I checked with the Treasurer, and we had $400 or $500 million, four and a half, I believe, $450 million that were borrowed on TANs just to, early on.
$777 or $778 million.
So it was over $700 million. And that was just to meet the deficiency in the general fund. Representative Patrick?
Well, and I think the point as well, I mean, we didn't have to go through this exercise if you would have told me the whole time that we're going to have a deficit issue the whole time. You know, when we asked the question, what about the $2.1 million in reserves that you want to get? That's basically going to be lent to other agencies and going to be used in the
I
in the pool. So, I mean, that's a good answer, but that's the answer. But and I apologize if I didn't articulate the question well. But, I mean, I think we need to help communicate that to other members who think we have large cash reserves lying around, and I would appreciate it if the State Treasurer's Office could give us an analysis or an explanation of how it works and what, you know, on a one- or two-page deal so we understand what's going on, because that's the only place
these budgets are. Dallas has an excellent printout that he does for me, for my constituents that occasionally come to me about all of this money that the Treasurer's sitting on, and I think it's called the Kafferman Report for the Consolidated Annual Financial Reports that people believe that we do have this enormous keg of cash that we're sitting on. And that is the case. Treasury has reported that we're actually managing on a day-to-day basis nearly $50 billion, but that represents funds that are largely dedicated, whether it's PERS or the Unemployment Reserve. Those are funds that we're just not going to be able to reach in and take out of there for, you know, someone's program because it seems to have better efficacy than someone else. Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I would just like to add my encouragement to Representative Patrick's idea that you in your office speak to that issue. There is a huge amount of misunderstanding about it, and having some pronouncement from the Treasurer's office, I think, would be very helpful.
Mr. Chair, all members of the committee, I mean, and I guess we're open for suggestions about how you think we could most effectively present that, whether it goes before the full Ways and Means and explain it, or go send out a letter to the members. I mean, I think this has been a very good dialogue, because I think we now understand. I mean, I really appreciate what you were asking. Unfortunately, we didn't quite understand the question, but I think that's really a good point, because the point is we are not sitting on extra money.
Well, I think that, sorry.
In answer to your question, I do both. I think it would be very useful to have a live in-person exchange with the full Ways and Means, and then a follow-up letter that would be available for members to respond to questions that come from their district, in addition to the very good work that LFO has done in responding to what was about 2 weeks ago a spate of emails and a flurry of activity around that subject. I would do both, and a further suggestion would be maybe some continuing commentary from the Treasurer's office to the full Ways and Means on the issue of debt. And I know that there's a debt advisory committee that I believe our chair serves on with you, but I think to make sure that the entire body is aware of the ramifications of our current debt situation, the use of TANs. To be truthful, I knew that TANs were being used. I understood intellectually why. I had no idea the amount was as high as you just indicated that it was. And I think to share that information on a broader venue would be useful to the understanding of all of the Ways and Means folks as well as all of our colleagues.
Mark? Senator Patrick's interruption. Or Senator Devlin, I beg your pardon.
In your indication that we are actually going to be, in a sense, running a deficit in terms of general fund availability from day two of the biennium till the final day of the biennium, in the sense that, we will be borrowing from the beginning to the end to stay. And since we have, this is sort of the opposite of your having the large reserves that nobody understands what they are for, PERS, the unemployment, all that. Since we do have also substantial COPs that are general fund backed, somebody could make the case that we are borrowing to pay our bills. But we're borrowing actually, in a sense, we're borrowing on our credit cards to pay for the credit that we've already taken out. So we're borrowing money to pay for the COPs on a regular basis, in a sense. Make the payments on the COPs.
Basically, that is that's actually the case, because if we have to borrow TANs to cover the current obligation to pay COPs, then you're borrowing from one credit source to pay on another credit source, in effect. Now, recognize that budgetarily, we budget dedicated sources to do that, but the collections may not have caught up with the actual obligation to provide for that COP. And therein, Senator Devlin, you're absolutely correct. We are borrowing from one source to pay off on another borrowed source, or another obligated, previously long-term obligated source. Would that be correct, Mr. Treasurer?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, and back to Mr. Chair, I think is how that went. It is correct on a cash flow basis that we'll be in deficit positions, and so we'll be borrowing to pay for debt service on COPs, et cetera. But again, on a budget basis, the budget will balance. And so at the end of the biennium, on June 30th, everything comes clean.
Yeah, it has to be at zero at that particular point in order to meet our obligation. Representative Patridge?
Well, Chair, I might suggest that you try and boil it down to language that people can understand, either on a business model or, I mean, we're running like a business would on a credit line that makes some sense, and try and boil some of these things down into workable chunks that actually people can understand, because I think we have an obligation to really to educate the members, and in turn that helps educate the public, we hope, as to what the situation is. Because there are many members on both sides of the aisle who are running around saying we have these extra, we have these extra reserves, and don't understand, And I didn't understand fully to any great degree at all, and I've been sitting down here for 3 years, and I think it might be helpful for the chair and maybe the treasurer to do a little roadshow with some support maybe from LFO and your office, Randall, with the caucuses, frankly, to prepare some kind of presentation that would work so people have an understanding, because...
Do the roadshow after we get the issues taken care of in Harney County, so don't wear my hat.
All right. But I really think I would encourage you to do that in the next week or two before the co-chair's budget comes out, before people understand what's going on, and really do some outreach. And if you need help or need to do any bouncing presentations off, I hate to volunteer the valuable time of the chair.
Well, thank you very much, Representative Patrick. I would say this, to augment what you just said, I know there are members of my caucus who really believe that we're pulling the wool over their eyes with regard to the amounts of money that are sitting in reserve at the Treasury, that they sincerely believe that there is some large amount of fund, whether it's general fund or otherwise, that don't know that they distinguish or differentiate, that somehow that the Treasurer has sequestered away in consort with other folks to keep that out of the hands of you know, the meaningful programs that they would like to advance. And we've got to be able to overcome that, and I think this discussion has been healthy in that regard. Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I agree with you. This has been a very healthy exchange. However, I would like to point out to you that you have invested me with an awesome responsibility in this committee, and that as a result of this very productive dialogue with the Treasurer, you owe the pig $1.25 for your use of TANs and COP.
We have Representative Johnson to keep track of it. So. Do this for a long time, Representative Johnson. Thank you very much.
It's just part of our rigorous honesty policy, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there other questions for the Treasurer?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to engage in this discussion, because I think we maybe weren't quite as aware of the lack of knowledge, perhaps, of all members of kind of where we were. And in part, it goes back to the first special session we started talking about the use of tax anticipation notes. And, that there is a trend. There's been a historic trend of how we got to this position as well. And the recession and that impact on the budget has just compounded an overall tendency of the body to keep lowering our cash balances to a point now where we're seeing a spike below zero and staying below, which was unprecedented, and hence we had to go out and borrow. And that is going to continue. It's an operational, and just like you're in a business and you're in a down cycle, you're going to have lines of credit to help manage your cash to pay the bills. It's not an ideal position to be. Fortunately, if there's any silver lining, the notes that we did borrow were very inexpensive. But that's still a cost, and we should try to not have that. So that's a longer-term discussion, but I think it's really important, and I appreciate the opportunity to work with the chair and whomever else to go out and try to educate members about where we sit.
And also in conjunction with the reports of the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission, the treasurer writes a summary as to at the preface of that report, which gives a pretty good explanation of some of the high level points that we could do to change what it is that we the issues that we have relative to debt in the state of Oregon, including issues of having rainy day funds and the concern over the fairly loose initiative process that Oregon experiences, as well as the overall kicker on a biennial basis right now, which may be addressed with Senator Devlin's bill for annual sessions. So, further questions for the Treasurer, Representative or Senator Devlin?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All I wanted to say was in terms of the sentiment out there that some members of both chambers and both caucuses might believe that there's more money out there in terms of reserves that could be accessed, or that they see these large numbers, and maybe I shouldn't state it exactly this way, but if you've got three choices, if you are desperate and you know the situation we're in, and your choices are to make cuts that you really don't want to make, to go out after revenue that you really don't want to go out after, or to believe that there is some miracle, that there's some money out there that you don't know, the easiest one of those choices is to believe that there's some reserve out there that you haven't seen, that there's some miracle, rather than making the cuts and going out for more revenue.
Moving to the miracle. That's the easiest choice to go to.
There's a lot of miracle workers running around this building.
Oh, yeah. There's at least 90 of them performing miracles left and right. Thank you very much. Just one last item, and that's something I've talked to the Treasurer a long time about, as long as I've got the Treasurer and Representative Johnson in the room at the same time. I still would like to see the state of Oregon seek authority from the director of the Mint, the U.S. Mint, to see if the state couldn't mint a legal tender silver Lewis and Clark, or a silver and or a gold Lewis and Clark legal tender coin. That's something that I think if we could do that in conjunction with the Treasurer's office, programs such as the education programs and the endowment programs that the state treasurer runs could be benefited by that by any resources there, and I still would like to see that done. Representative Johnson.
Thank you for raising that, Mr. Chair. It is fortuitous that you did. I just had a discussion with the governor's office. As many people know, each state gets a chance at having a quarter that has some unique thing, and there has been some discussion about possibly employing the Jeffersonian peace and friendship coin that Lewis and Clark carried with. I'm informed by the governor's office that there will be a lengthy process that will allow competitive design to come forward, with the ultimate authority resting in the governor to make the selection. But the governor's office did suggest, and I'm speaking to you in the context of being the head of the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial Commemoration for the state, the governor's office did suggest that we have a subcommittee of the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial Organization get with the treasurer's office and at least have some discussion in the context of a broader a solicitation of designs.
And Representative Johnson, I would like to see that go, and I've expressed this in the treasurer, go well beyond the commemorative quarter and actually have a perhaps a $5 silver piece and a $50 gold piece or something of that nature that could be legal tender. Canada produces them on a fairly regular basis. And Treasurer, you had a comment. I beg your pardon.
Well, my chief of staff is itching to correct the record about the quarter, I guess.
For the record, Kate Richardson, chief staff, Oregon State Treasury. Actually, the governor's office does not make a decision about the quarter. The decision about what would be on the commemorative quarter resides in the director of the U.S. Mint, and the state submits 3 to 5 conceptual designs, not drawings, but conceptual designs to them, and then the decisions lie with the director of the Mint.
Thank you for that correction. That dispels erroneous information that I had.
We're working very closely with them on this, and so we're sort of coordinating an effort with them to figure out how we're going to provide those 3 to 5 drawings.
That coin would not be unique, as I expressed to the treasurer once previously. In 1926 through 1938, Oregon had a 50-cent
coin that was minted and in circulation. Those coins sell for anywhere from a few hundred to a few thousands of dollars now. But the 50-cent Westward Wagons coin that was a commemorative coin was in circulation for over a period of about 20 years and was a very popular, extremely popular coin by the number of that were actually minted and their price today. So I would really like to see us be able to capitalize on that and then bring back some revenue back to the state of Oregon by making it a legal tender coin. But that's from an old coin buff. And so with that.
Well, knowing that we have a ready market, I'll take that as advice from the chair to follow up with the treasurer.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Treasurer. Thank you very much. With that, we will close the hearing on the treasurer's budget.
We just have money all over the place here.
Yes, I apologize, Linda. Thank you, Ben. If you watch the pennies on the floor, then you don't need to worry about the dollars in the bank.
There's truth to that.
Thank you, Mike. Now you thought we were going to have the Racing Commission today, didn't you?
Good.
April Fool.
Gee, you mean we're adjourned for the day?
No, we're not.
I thought maybe you were feeling sorry for my sinus head this morning.
I apologize, Sandra. We will open a hearing on Senate Bill 5540 for the Racing Commission. Today, Paul Siebert is here from the Legislative Fiscal Office. We'll continue with Karen Siegrist as our clerk. And we're going to go ahead and open it up. We're due to have an earthquake drill. And what we've done is we've canceled the earthquake drill. We have Senator Devlin just sneeze intermittently from time to time. All of us duck and cover when he sneezes. So.
Okay.
And that's no April Fool's. With that, let's see. Paul, will you introduce us to what we're going to be doing the next day and a half on the Racing Commission, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. You should have at your places a memo from LFO giving you a brief orientation and background.
He looked at your chat, Mr. Chair.
Also, you should have at your place the presentation that the agency will be going through. I just want to point out a few items on the memo. Number two is the budget notes, and it's maybe apropos of your discussion of ending balances, because the one budget note that was included in the commission's budget last session was a note directing the agency to maintain an ending balance equivalent to 6 months. The 2001-03 governor's recommended budget had reduced the ending balance to 3 months and transferred the remaining amount to the general fund. And the legislature decided that because of some uncertainty and some worries about potential revenue for hubs, that the agency should instead maintain a six-month ending balance. The agency did report to the emergency board on their expenditures and the status of their revenue and expenditures. And in fact, those concerns about revenue proved to be unfounded, because a number of multi-jurisdictional hubs are now operating in Oregon. And during, I believe it was the second special session, the commission was able to transfer some monies to the general fund from the revenue from I think there are five multi-jurisdictional hubs currently operating. And other than that, I would say that was really the most significant item from the commission's budget last time. And if the committee would like, maybe we'd start with the BAM presentation of the governor's budget.
Lori Bartley, happy to do that.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, I am Lori Byerly from the Department of Administrative Services Budget Management Division. I'm the analyst assigned to the Racing Commission, and I appreciate you letting me go first this morning. I'm also working in the ODOT hearing next door today, so I'm kind of back and forth. If you will, take a look at the packet that Paul just handed out to you. It's this familiar-looking gray thing. What I will do real briefly is give you a kind of a high-level overview of what's in the Racing Commission's budget for 2003-05. On page 2 of the document, you'll see a worksheet that kind of gives some budget comparison history over time. If you look at the columns on the far right, say change from, you'll see the change between the 2001-03 close of session budget and the governor's 03-05 balanced budget is about 22.2%. The increase between the fifth special session budget number and the 2003-05 budget number is about 18.2%. This increase is due primarily to the department's distribution of revenues related to the multi-jurisdictional hubs that Paul just mentioned in his overview. These are dollars that the agency receives from that program. A portion of those are statutorily set aside and dedicated to the promotion of racing within the state of Oregon, and the department has accelerated or bumped up the distribution of those dollars out to participants across the state, and they'll talk in the presentation about where those dollars are going out, but that's the primary change or increase there is related to those dollars. If you look at the positions and full-time equivalent, you'll see that it's remained pretty static. There's been no significant changes. If you take a look at page 3, you'll see that the governor's budget is 18.2% increase, like I just said, from the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget for the fifth special session. As Paul mentioned, there was a change made during the special session that does not show up on an expenditure side, but on the revenue side, the department increased the amount of funding it transfers to the general fund over the course of 0103 by $750,000. So these revenues went directly to the general fund and were used to help offset general fund reductions. So the total amount that the commission transfers in 0103 is about $1.5 million. That number does drop down to just under $600,000 for the 0305 budget. And that's related to the commission's ending balances and its ongoing needs for cash flow. The budget reflects growth in revenue from these multi-jurisdictional hubs. As over time, the agency's revenue related to live and simulcast racing has been dropping, while this revenue related to hubs has been climbing. Right now, the hub revenue is about 46% of the dollars that the commission brings in for activities. Currently, the state has five of these multi-jurisdictional hubs. The commission receives a licensing fee for these hubs to operate, as well as a portion of the handle or wagering revenues from these operations comes into the commission. They're currently receiving 0.25 of 1% of these wagering revenues. Two-thirds of the revenue goes into the development fund for racing inside Oregon, which I mentioned previously, that's distributed out. The other third goes to the general fund. The budget continues current programs. It increases support for fair race meets. This is part of that developmental fund I just mentioned. Some of the activities these dollars have been going out to include purses for for county fair and other race meets, as well as jockey incentive dollars. And there are also some dollars being distributed for facility improvements for some of these small operations. If you'd like to take a look on page 4, you can see how the commission spends its money by budget category. You'll see about half of the commission's budget is in the personal services arena, a portion in special payments. These include those dollars going out of the development account, and then some service and supplies dollars to support ongoing operational activities. How we developed the Racing Commission's 2003-05 budget is we started with the 2001-03 legislatively adopted budget of $3.9 million other funds. This is on page 5. Added in changes that had been made by the legislature up through April 2002. There were no changes made on the expenditure side. Later on in the biennium, there was a change made to the revenue transfer. No change made on the expenditure side. We also included base budget adjustments for costs related to 2001-03 position actions and compensation changes. Based on the governor's balanced budget, there needs to be some adjustments made to these figures due to the freezing of merit increases as well as some cost of living increases. On page 6, essential and policy packages in the budget. Package 010 includes some adjustments for personal services-related costs that are not driven directly by positions. This includes an increase of overtime costs of $1,000. Package 030 includes inflation for priceless adjustments and state government service charges of about $57,000. Package 090 was a program reduction. We took a look at the department's expenditure pattern and what it had in the budget and determined that we could make a reduction in the other services and supplies line item to match up with that expenditure pattern, reduce that by $25,000.
Any specific line item?
Chair Butler, the specific line item is the line item called the other services and supplies line item.
Okay.
That's its name. And package 101 is a package that does increase that hub revenue distribution as provided by statute of expenditure of the Oregon Paramutual Racing Industry. We increased that by about $540,000 in that package, which will let the commission pay out on some of those projects and requests coming in from the industry. That concludes my high-level presentation. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much, Lori. And looking at the under budgets, I think it is, agency summary, page 20, I'm looking for 090. Is it published on the...
On the record? Chair Butler, what page are you looking at?
Under agency summary, budget page 20, is 090 listed in there? I see 010 or 101. I missed that.
Chair Butler, I can't find it on the current service level form either. But if you were to look at the printed reports in the back, you'd find it.
Printed reports in the back on the special report
on page. 6 of 8 of the supporting document in the back under the special reports tab.
Okay. Takes 100% of that line. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Barlow. Are there questions for either Paul or Lori? Seeing none, let's just go right on in then to the presentation. The Oregon Racing Commission. Please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Jody Hansen, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Racing Commission. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to be here today to present our 2003-05 budget. I've only been with the commission a few weeks, so I brought along a couple of reinforcements. This is Steve Walters. He is the chair of the Racing Commission, and he has been generous enough to volunteer over 12 years of his time, energy, and legal expertise to the commission. And also Carol Morgan, seated directly behind Mr. Walters, is the executive assistant of the commission, and she has been with the agency for 13 years. I kind of put together a little four-point outline from the requirements that is my understanding were requested from the committee, basically going over why our agency exists, how we've been performing, how the agency is using its budget, and what can be expected in terms of outcomes from its budget request. I'll start with number one, why the agency exists. And the mission of the Oregon Racing Commission is to regulate all aspects of the paramutual industry in the state of Oregon for the benefit of the citizenry, the licensees, the participants, and the state of Oregon. So in other words, the agency is existing to protect the public, all licensed participants of the paramutual industry, and the state through fair neutral regulation. The Oregon Racing Commission was established in 1933. ORS Chapter 462 provides this statutory authority, and it's for the broad authorization of paramutual wagering. And our administrative rules are in OAR 462, and they cover and define general provisions such as the licensing, prohibited conduct, and paramutual wagering operations through specific rules which govern live horse and greyhound racing, simulcasting, and, of course, the multi-jurisdictional simulcasting and interactive wagering totalizer hubs, which is a very long phrase. That's kind of why we exist in a nutshell. And number two, how the agency has been performing. The Oregon Racing Commission has developed some goals to accompany the commission's performance measures, and there's five of those. Number one is to ensure that races are run safely. And number two is to provide a humane environment for racing animals. Number three is to ensure that races are run fairly. Number four is to provide a regulatory framework to allow simulcasting to enhance live racing at commercial tracks. And number five is to provide a regulatory framework to allow the licensing of the multi-jurisdictional simulcasting and interactive wagering totalizer hubs that meet the necessary qualifications to enhance live racing activities in Oregon without causing adverse impact to other jurisdictions. The commission is established, it's performing well, and we believe that it is accomplishing its mission. The commission has developed a really positive rapport with its industry, which has really done a great job as far as promoting and increasing voluntary compliance, which is really a wonderful thing with a regulatory agency. And the appendixes 1 through 6 of the more formal budget presentation, it kind of outlines some of the activities that we're doing and how we're doing. I know that in the past you received handouts from the former executive director, and it just kind of goes through some of the things that we're doing, such as our licensing, how many licenses we're issuing. We actually have several thousand licenses, about 5,000 on average, that are three-year licenses. And currently, in this last year, from July 1st to March 8th of 2003, we've issued 1,089 licenses, and we're expecting to issue about 1,600 by the end of this year and biennium. And that's about standard over the last couple of years.
So you're on track to issue the licenses that you're asking?
Yes, we are, Mr. Chair.
And that there's 110 different licenses?
We issue approximately 110 different licenses. It's really interesting because everybody that has anything to do with horse racing or live dog racing or any of the simulcasting is licensed, and that's all the way from the people who do the grooming to the owners to the people who take the horses onto the tracks, the jockeys.
So there's a license for grooming horses?
There's a license for just about everything, yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
How much do I pay for a license to groom horses?
Mr. Chair, licenses are $30 for the three-year period.
Does that let me groom all the horses I want, or do I just get to groom certain horses that are winners? Or?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Steve Walters, the chair of the Racing Commission. It allows you to work for a trainer on the backside of a racetrack and help care for the horse, which... it also includes mucking out the stalls and doing some other things rather than just...
I got to pay for that, too.
Yes, you do, Mr. Chair.
But it's assumed that somewhere in that process, the owner's going to pay me, so I have a license to muck out the stalls, and then he pays me for that. Are there a lot of folks that line up for those kinds of licenses?
Mr. Chair, there are a lot of folks who that's pretty much all they can do, it's what they love to do is to work with horses. So it's an industry that provides jobs for people who are sort of single-skill people.
Lining up for the legislature next. Representative Johnson.
I apologize for being outside, Mr. Chair, but I was led to believe by some of the distinguished commissioners that the reason for their service was the mucking out the stalls issue. And I would be very happy if it was within the purview of this committee to help specify through a budget note or some other way that might fall within the purview of the commissioners.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I try to spend quite a bit of time on the back. I haven't mucked out a stall yet, but I would be glad to do that.
Well, I want you to know that shoveling out a horse stall would really prepare you for the legislature.
And Mr. Chair, there are some, I believe, on the commission who have had the opportunity to have the experience on both sides. They might be uniquely suited to help lead that effort on behalf of the commission.
You're going to have to wear
waiters
on this committee after lunch.
All right. Please continue, Jody.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to how our agency has been performing. We believe that races are being run as safely as possible. An example is the performance measure established by the commission for horses being destroyed is less than 1.5 horses destroyed per 1,000 starters, meaning of the 1,000 horses that start races, less than 1.5 of those will have to be euthanized for some injury purpose. In 2000, the ratio per 1,000 starters was 2.5. In 2001, the ratio was for starters, 1,000 starters was 1.1. In 2002, the ratio per 1,000 starters was 0.6 per 1,000. And I have to say that really reflects good regulatory oversight and veterinary care. In other states, the way that they do their measurement and figure out their statistics, the average is 2 horses destroyed per 1,000 starters. In many of the other states, they don't count the horses that have to be destroyed once they're removed from the track. They only count them if they have to destroy them on the track. In Oregon, the way we keep our statistics is that we monitor all the horses that have to be euthanized after a race, whether they're on the track or they're taken back to another area of the track. So our
they had to have started.
Well, they had to have started. So our statistics show a really good low ratio. Another aspect is our commission horse stewards and greyhound judges, after inquiry and hearing, implement sanctions against licensees who violate our statutes and rules. This information is submitted to the commission and remains fairly consistent. Back in those appendices, there's a handout that kind of goes over the number of violations that have been issued by the horse stewards and greyhound judges. There's a section for greyhounds and a section for horses. The use of 3 officials, 2 are from the commission and 1 is from the industry association, is designed to protect the integrity of racing and protect the wagering public as well. So everybody's represented in that judging body. Chemical testing through a contracted laboratory for winning race animals and other animals which may be on a special list because there's been problems with a trainer in the past. We also do chemical testing on participants, such as jockeys. This testing program also protects the integrity of racing and the wagering public. Photo finish services are currently being utilized through a contracted service by statute, and this assists judges and stewards in determining the actual placement of a finisher. This also protects the integrity of racing and the wagering public. It is a very huge concern for the commission to provide a humane environment for these racing animals. The commission annually reviews our administrative rules pertaining to the welfare and safety of racing animals. The Greyhound, Oregon Greyhound Association, in conjunction with 3 volunteer adoption groups, also successfully places retired racing greyhounds into really good homes. And people ship greyhounds from all over the country to have their retired racing greyhounds actually adopted out through Oregon. Also, one thing that I think is really fantastic is that through the cooperation of the Greyhound, Multnomah Greyhound Park, they actually can track every single greyhound from the time it comes to the track to where it's going afterwards. And there's one, the racing director actually spends time following each animal to make sure that it's safely arrived at either a location for additional racing, or it's gone to a farm, or it's being adopted out. So there's a really good follow-through.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you for that explanation. I understood that there may be a bill making its way through the process right now that speaks to the disposition of racing greyhounds, and I'm trying to understand what problem that bill attempts to correct, given that you've provided a rather comprehensive description of a humane adoption methodology for racing greyhounds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I would like to defer that answer to Steve Walters, because he has worked with that group extensively that filed the bill, and we also had a rules hearing with similar rules on that exact issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the Racing Commission for a number of years has had a rule requiring the filing of a disposition report and a very good history of tracking the greyhounds. We testified on the Senate side regarding that bill and expressed the view that it wasn't necessary given our rules and track record to coin a phrase, and at the same time that the bill was pending, we were in the process of revising our greyhound rules, and the proponents of the bill submitted a proposed rule change in Oregon. We did not adopt the rule in that form, although we adopted parts of it as our rule. And so, you know, we think we have a very good program in place, and are not aware that there is a need for the bill.
Follow up, Representative Johnson.
No, thank you.
Do we know where that bill is at this particular time? Is it going forward as a result of the work that you've done?
Mr. Chair, there was a public hearing on the bill. My understanding is that there's been no further activity on the bill since that.
Do the proponents of the bill feel like that the issues are being adequately addressed then?
Mr. Chair, I don't know whether they do or not.
Okay. Thank you very much. Please proceed. I'm sorry, Senator Winters.
You stated that you adopted some of the components. What were the components that you did not adopt?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, provisions that we didn't adopt principally had to do with personal identifying information that the proponents wanted us to adopt by rule and make available publicly. There was a great deal of concern expressed in our public hearing on the rules by, for example, people who work with the adoption agencies, that publishing that sort of information by the people adopting greyhounds would deter people from adopting greyhounds, that the volunteers who worked with the organizations were concerned about having personal identification published. And frankly, the explanation given to us by the proponents is that they wanted to check criminal histories of people who were involved with greyhounds. The commission, of course, does that as part of its licensing process, and the information that the proponents were requesting would not have enabled them to track criminal histories in any event. So that was a big area of contention in the public hearing we had on our rule.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to how the agency is performing. We also have commission auditors who are meticulous in how they track the live, simulcast, and multi-jurisdictional hubs in Oregon. This information, another thing that goes along with this as an example is that we have a website through www.oregon.gov. And we continually are updating our website as far as the amount of the handle, which is the total amount of money wagered, and what is the proportion of that comes to the state, and it's called the take. So this information is available for anybody to log on and look. Also, we put our annual reports on there for anybody to log on and check to see how we're doing and where our money's being spent. The information as far as violations as from the stewards and the greyhound judges is on. Actually, it's the horse racing that's on there. So there's a lot of information that's out there, not only for the public but for our licensees, and they do follow it regularly.
From a practical standpoint, Jody, is that done by contract or from the list of employees that I see here? Is that done from your employee list? The auditing, meticulous live track, those kinds of things. Is that done by contract?
Mr. Chair, that's done by our employees. We have three people who do the licensing and auditing in that area, and the auditing is specifically done mostly by one person. And also, all of our internet updates and all of our computer support is done by that unit, and it's been cost effective for us.
I guess as I look down the list of employees, which is the last sheet or two sheets. I think I've got two sheets that are the same in my book. if I look down this list, I see I see the following. I see Executive Manager B, Executive Manager C, Executive Support Specialist 2, and then there's two Executive Manager Ds, one Executive Manager C, two Executive Manager Ds, one C, one E, and then another Office Specialist. I guess until I get down to that point, I've got...
principals and things.
Appears to be 10 of the 17 folks that you've got there that are executive managers. Is one of those somewhere your audit or auditors?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And I'm not clear, you know, I should have matched up the person with the actual category, and maybe Carol Morgan can help with that.
Back to the organization chart. Where is the organization chart located in the book? Is it under general information?
Thank you for your patience, Mr. Chair.
No, that's fine. I'm sorry. This is part of the initiation process. You didn't get my memo about April 1st, did you? Organization chart appears to be on budget page 22 under agency summary.
I can, my name is Carol Morgan. I'm the exec assistant. And probably the best way for me to be able to describe them, since I don't know exactly, I can tell you which positions are the manager exec positions. I can't tell you which classification right off the top of my head. Of course, the exec director is the presiding steward, the deputy steward are exec manager positions. The presiding judge and deputy judge are exec manager positions, but they are seasonal. They are only run from about mid-April through the second week in October. And they are for Greyhound Racing only.
Where are those at, Carol? I'm sorry.
I'm going from the left to the right.
Okay.
So you've got your presiding steward, your deputy steward. Then going to the right, you've got a presiding judge and a deputy judge.
Right.
Okay, those are seasonal.
Including the relief steward and the phone.
The relief stewards are only there if one of the regular stewards is not available. They are on an on-call basis.
So these are all seasonal.
Mm-hmm. But just the presiding judge and the deputy judge.
Okay.
The presiding steward, deputy steward are year-round, full-time employees. Then continuing on, does that answer your question, Chair?
Well, I guess one of the things I'm going to be cognizant of here, Carol, is that we've got a lot of managers. One of the concerns I've got in all of my departments is to make sure that the number of chiefs to the number of Indians has some rationale.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm looking at this, the first dozen positions, it appears that 10 of them are executive positions. And two of them are office specialists, two and office specialists.
The office specialists are not a manager position.
Right. And so that's the 12, then two of them are office or executive support. Executive support specialist two, and I assume
that's me.
You write to the executive director.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Now that I'm looking at the organizational chart, I can clarify it a little bit more. And it's my understanding that these classifications were in place because there wasn't really an area where these kind of unique positions fit within the entire state classification system. The presiding and the deputy steward judges are Class Ds. The presiding judge and deputy judge for the Greyhounds are Class Cs, or the presiding judge is a D and the deputy judge is a C. Same with the presiding and deputy stewards for the horses. It's a D and a C. The chief investigator is a C. The supervisor of licensing and paramutuals is a C. And the commission veterinarians are Ds. Occasionally we have to hire relief veterinarians, and those are just a part-time. Basically, they're paid on a shift basis.
Contracted employees.
Yes.
or? Well, they're in the state payroll system, and they fill the classification of a D, but they are paid on a daily rate.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Winters, please.
It would be helpful, I think, in going through this budget, recognizing that there are some uniqueness, and there's also where they're not really, some of them are full-time, as I gathered from the conversation, if, you know, they could bring us back and talk about those that are part-time and how much time and what the rates are. So, and I think you'd have a better understanding of
that would be security. That would be helpful to just amplify the org chart if we could.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, along those same lines, the explanation that you just gave verbally of the positions, if you give that in writing also.
Yeah, just fill in the blanks, if you would please, Jody, on your organization chart.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I may make one comment. The reason for the number of executive positions in the Racing Commission, as Senator Winters observed, this is a unique type of agency. Each of these executive classification positions are people with a unique set of skills and long experience in training that is not easy to find. And so, for example, stewards go through a rigorous accreditation process. Our stewards have years and years of experience judging horses or being presiding over race meets. The same is true with, obviously, veterinarians with greyhound judges, a very unique set of skills. And that is the reason we have sort of an odd-looking organizational chart and sort of an executive-heavy set of classifications.
Thank you very much, Steve. And I guess I was looking when I see that the commission auditors meticulously track lives of the race. I was looking for the auditors here, and I'm not sure which are the audit positions here, but somewhere we'll know who the auditors are. That's sometimes a term of art, auditor, and I get a little sensitive about that. Senator Winters
and Mr. Chair, thank you. As there, it appears some of their functions are changing as racing is on the decline and simulcasting and hubs is on the increase, if I look at what's happening in the organization. So it would appear to me that that would also reflect in how your staff is being utilized and whether you don't have the same capacity needs, I would think, over time, and whether the commission is looking at that particular issue.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, that is certainly something that we are very sensitive to and looking at. Actually, the reality is, I think if you look at some of the other statistics, we are running about the same number of greyhound and horse races in the state of Oregon. The amount bet on those live races has gone down, but the Racing Commission has viewed its mission as supporting what is essentially an agricultural industry in the state of Oregon with the breeding and raising and racing of live animals, and the other aspects of it, the newer technologies are used to enhance and support that. So the supervision of a race meet is a personnel intensive business, and those needs don't seem to have changed, but that is something we are looking at.
I have a question. What is the situation now currently with meadows and the environmental issues, and are those issues popping up any place else where you have racing meets?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, the Portland Meadows, which is now the operating rights, are owned by Magna Entertainment. They have dealt with the environmental issues on, I believe, a four-year permit. They are working to resolve them on a permanent basis, and we're confident that they will do that. Those issues have not arisen at other race meets because at Multnomah Greyhound Park, you don't have the same environmental issues and runoff issues. And at the smaller race meets, they tend to be in drier areas, first of all. And secondly, they don't meet the consecutive day requirement for what's called a CAFO operation under the environmental protection laws. So no, we have not had those issues elsewhere.
You mentioned follow there. That the mission is expanding to go out and
look at all aspects of the racing industry and some of the horses and greyhound industry. The actual mission statement doesn't cover all of the things that you're doing. It appears that you're doing something rather substantially more than that. And perhaps with the evolution of paramutual activities in the state of Oregon and the work with the hub, maybe that deserves some sort of reexamination of the actual mission statement, too.
Right, Mr. Chair, I agree with you. Again, we do see our focus as supporting a live racing industry, which is an agricultural industry in the state of Oregon, but obviously our workload and our responsibilities are expanding greatly with the simulcasting and the hubs.
Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, with my apologies to the committee and to the audience, I need to be excused to go testify on a bill, and I think we're seeing this tomorrow as well.
Yes, we will be, Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just for that, you won't show up in the Statesman as having
that was
missed
the
part
of my
it.
Comments.
I recognize it. Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out a couple more areas where we think that we're doing some good things in Oregon, and that is the through the assistance of that two-thirds of the 0.025 of 1% that comes in from the multi-jurisdictional hubs, we've been able to help support live racing at summer fairs, which benefit many of the small communities in these five areas. We have actually get a lot of phone calls from out of state from people calling to inquire the actual dates for the summer fair meets so that they can come to Oregon and have their vacations here and participate in the small community activities. Also, the citizens of Oregon are benefiting as well from paramutual racing from the one-third of the 0.025 of 1% that is returned to the general fund for use in other important programs. Number three, how the agency uses its budget. The agency is using its budget to fulfill its statutory requirements, which are outlined in 462 and directly correlate with the mission goals and our performance measures. And these mandates include licensing, regulating, and supervising race meets and participants held in the state. The commission, in its sole discretion, is authorized to either accept or reject any application for a race meet license. Another aspect is preparing and promulgating administrative rules to cover every phase of operation for the health, welfare, and humane practices, public safety, and conducts of hearings in accordance with the Administrative Procedures Act. And again, the commission reviews its rules at least annually, and they are very up-to-date. Maintain an office, keep detailed records of meetings, business transactions, prepare and publish an annual report, which is also, again, available on our internet site, and cooperating with other state racing commission boards and racing organizations to enforce laws regulating racing, share information, and study and detect drugs to carry out programs for the betterment of racing. Requiring, per rule, chemical analysis of racing animals and licensed persons. Currently, the cost of this testing is paid by the commission. That is in statute. This is an area that is a concern in some ways. I mean, it is an issue in this industry. We have a veterinarian who does a really good job of tracking how testing is done and is doing some studying as well. Obtaining photo patrol of the racing to assist the stewards in resolving disputes or claims. We actually have people that come in to view these tapes, generally on Wednesday mornings. People who have questions about a race that happened over the weekend can call the steward and they can come in and look at that video if they have a concern. Of course, we license and regulate race course and off-course mutual wagering at our off-track betting sites, licensing and regulating multi-jurisdictional simulcasting and their employees working in this state. Again, everybody is licensed in some respect. Of the monies received under statute as the multi-jurisdictional simulcasting hub tax, 33 and a third is retained and paid to the state treasurer for deposit in the general fund, and 66 and two-thirds is retained by the commission and distributed per administrative rule for the benefit of the Oregon paramutual racing industry. Again, the board of judges and stewards may, after an investigation and hearing, impose sanctions for failure to comply with the laws and rules of racing. And, of course, if there's a disagreement with that ruling, it's appealed to the hearing officer panel.
Have you had it, Mr. Chair?
Senator.
Have you had any disputes that come before the hearing officer panel?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, yes, we do. We have currently... there is about six administrative hearings that are in the process of resolution with the hearing officer panel. And back in the appendices in the other report, let's see, you can see on the on page 1 of 2, appendix 3, that is the horse racing stats that are kept by the stewards. And if you look on page 2, it will talk about hearings. For 2002, there have been 28 formal hearings and 8 informal hearings. And, of course, then appeals are kept by our office. And currently there's about 6 cases that are undergoing various stages of the hearing officer panel procedure through the Administrative Procedures Act.
Is that why you're...
AG
is so high, $10,000.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we have a couple of big cases that are under appeal right now.
Mr. Chair and Senator Winters, yes, that's the reason. It's a very highly regulated industry. There are violations that range from the equivalent of a overtime parking violation to violations that are very, very serious. And so our Assistant Attorney General must work very closely with the investigators and the stewards and the veterinarians in tracking these various violations that inevitably will occur in an industry of this sort, and then there are some larger cases that go to the hearings examiner. So yes, that's the reason for the high number.
You have some of those cases that are obviously resolved. Maybe you could tell us what your most expensive resolved case is in the immediate history.
Mr. Chair, I suppose I would have to go back to my early days on the Racing Commission, and it was a case involving, unfortunately, the race meet operator at Portland Meadows who misappropriated some money.
Oh, okay.
And that took many formal hearings, many court proceedings. Eventually, the Racing Commission prevailed in all of those. But that certainly is the most expensive since I can remember. We have had others relating to, again, a more recent unfortunate incident with a greyhound owner and trainer who was transporting some greyhounds to Florida, and he ran into some severe weather conditions, and 6 of them died. His license was revoked, and he no longer is involved in greyhound racing in Oregon or anywhere else. But that was a high-profile and major decision. We have a couple others in process now that I really don't think I can talk about.
And that's fine. I don't expect that you would talk about any, but so to revoke someone's license for actually being involved in the unfortunate death of some animals, that goes through a lengthy appeal process and with the attorneys and so forth?
Mr. Chair, yes, it does.
Okay. Senator?
Before the hearing panel was created, what was your process of dealing with those kinds of issues?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, there would be a hearing before the stewards or the judges, and that is still the case, with rights of appeal directly to the Racing Commission. And the Racing Commission would sit either as one of us would sit as a hearings officer or the entire and make a recommendation to the full commission, or the entire commission would sit and hear the case. Now we actually make the final decision on recommendations from the hearing officer. But it doesn't take as much of our time.
It doesn't take you away from the process of what you used to do in the past. You still hear it.
We still hear it in, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we still hear it in a much more streamlined form. We get a recommended order from a hearings examiner. We can delve into as much of the record as we need to understand in taking action on the order. But we are able to do that in the course of a regular scheduled meeting rather than having special hearings scheduled and that type of thing.
In your... work with the hearings officer, the hearing panel, does the Department of Justice represent you in that action, or do you represent yourself?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, the Department of Justice does.
So in the past you would have done it yourself, and now you have yourself plus DOJ?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, no. In the past, the Assistant Attorney General assigned to as the General Counsel to the Racing Commission always handled the hearings.
All of them before?
Yes.
Okay. But your budget's going up.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, yes, it is. I believe that reflects perhaps more hearings, perhaps increased rates from the Attorney General's office.
Rates. Yeah. Thank you.
Please continue.
Mr. Chair and Senator Winters, just one more clarification about the Attorney General costs. We also, because we do review our administrative rules on a regular basis, we also have their assistance in going through and looking at them to make sure that they're okay.
I do have a question. Senator? Have you had the same AG consistently for a number of years, or have you had a turnover in AGs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I've been on the commission for 12 years. We've had three assistant attorneys general during that time. So we've had fairly steady representation, which has been very much to our benefit.
So yours is a situation that happens with some agencies where they've had turnover, so they've actually had to train the AG first before they could actually get the product out.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we've only had to train a new one three times during my tenure on the Racing Commission.
And that's how long?
12 years.
12 years. Okay.
Great.
Huh? Not bad.
Jody?
Mr. Chair and Senator Winters, the last point I wanted to make about our Attorney General is that the Commission meets 12 times a year and monthly, and the Assistant Attorney General is present during those meetings too, which last about 3 hours for legal advice if necessary.
Is that always necessary?
Is that always necessary would be my question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, it is, in our view, necessary because things come up during the course of the meeting where we need legal advice, and it's very hard for us to predict. We are able, and I do, for example, will tell the Assistant Attorney General he doesn't need to attend certain rules hearings and that sort of thing, and we have excused him from regular meetings on occasion. But given the law enforcement and regulatory nature of what we do, our practice has been to have him there, and we usually benefit from his presence.
I don't know. Perhaps as time goes on, Jody will have a better feel for the structure of the meetings as to what's going to be discussed, and you might be able to get some preliminary indication from your Attorney General so that you don't have to have a lawyer sitting there all the time. Unfortunately, we're seeing more and more of these boards that are controlled by lawyers. And being a lawyer ain't bad. Representative Patrick knows that.
Well,
the concern we've got,
leave now. Thank you very much.
The concern we've got is that this is not what these are intended to be. Senator Winters?
I just want to piggyback on that. It is becoming a concern that not only commissions who are there because you come with some expertise and what have you, but also agencies as well are being managed by lawyers. And I don't think, and we do have some very good lawyers who are managers, but it's becoming where it is causing some concern. And if you look at the budget issues and how much the various agencies now are spending for legal consultation, and it's a huge budget driver, and we're very concerned with what's occurring with commissions and agencies. And if you, it also says that you don't take any risks, so I share your concern, Mr. Chair, because I'm very concerned that we're becoming so legalistic that we have to go say Mother May I for everything we do, and I don't think that that is healthy from the standpoint of you doing your work as a commission or as an agency standpoint, that they cannot do anything without consulting with the AG's office first.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, thank you for that input, and I have to say that I'm so excited to be in this new position, and we do receive regular billings from the Assistant Attorney General's office, and I will make sure that as I get more familiar that the Assistant Attorney General isn't involved in any policy issues, and we only specifically use that person for technical legal advice.
Yeah, it might be that amongst your commissioners will have somebody that's been trained in the law that could tell you if there's a legal issue there or not. At which point, that's fine too. But it doesn't mean that. First of all, I appreciate the work that you're doing, Steve. But I don't know that we have to have the. When you're talking about during a period of 24 months in the biennium, 3 hours a meeting, 12 times a year, at nearly $100 an hour, I'm talking about thousands of dollars for having these folks bend paperclips. And I'd like to have them be able to be there only when we need them there, identified on those issues which are most salient, where they can apply their talents and their abilities.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that, and we will look at that issue very carefully. I don't know if it's an advantage or a disadvantage to have a lawyer chair a commission. We've had one for 10 years now.
Well, it always helps to have one on board that can tell you, I think that's a legal issue. And that's, and I've always appreciated that and recognized, too, that just because there is an attorney on the board doesn't mean that we just immediately turn to that person and say, fine, solve it. But they can identify it, or you folks are trained to be able to identify it.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, could I take a quick break, if I may?
We're just wrapped up right now,
okay. So
why don't we just go ahead and... Lori, we'll get back. Well, let's see. Lori, you're going to be in your other meetings tomorrow, I assume?
Chair Beller, actually, I think we've got mostly public hearing tomorrow, okay. So I could probably be here, I think.
All right. Well, we'll just continue on with Senate Bill 5540. With Jody, you're on page 3 of 4 right at the end there. Okay. With that, we'll stand adjourned until tomorrow.
Mr. Chair, unfortunately, I will not be able to be here tomorrow morning, but another commissioner will.